Ali is a fellow at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C., and he runs the online journal Electronic Intifada. Gilad is a senior research analyst with the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America, which monitors coverage of Israel in particular. Now, I know you guys disagree profoundly on the facts of the conflict. We're going to try and keep this focused on the coverage as best we can. I flipped a coin, and Gilad, I'm going to go to you first. You think NPR coverage favors the Palestinians, by and large. Is this a matter of just a few missed facts here or there, or is there some deeper, much more entrenched problem?
I think the problem goes beyond just a few missed facts here and there, although that's an issue as well. And although it's maybe a subtle problem, I do think it's a significant problem. But though it's subtle, it might not be apparent to the average listener. And I think that problem is, even though there is some good reporting and there is some unbalanced reporting, and oftentimes the facts are correct, most importantly, I think NPR isn't presenting listeners with a complete, rounded, and nuanced picture of the conflict. And to kind of explain what I mean by not a complete picture, there's one example that kind of captures that in a very, very direct way. And to do that, I have to look back to March of 2008 during a previous round of hostilities between Gaza and Israel, very similar to today, where there were rockets being fired from Gaza into Israeli towns and Israeli aerial response. And at the time, the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon released a statement, and in that statement he condemned Palestinian rocket attacks, and which he called terrorism, and then he went on to recognize Israel's right to defend itself, but he condemned what he saw as the disproportionate and excessive use of force that Israel has employed. A day or so later, on NPR's All Things Considered, the host, Robert Siegel, had a couple of guests. One was Israeli spokesman Mark Regev. Another was Palestinian Cabinet Minister Raed Malki. And when Mark Regev, the Israeli, was in the studio or on the phone, the host confronted him with Ban Ki-moon's statement, and he said, well, there are charges by Ban Ki-moon that your response is disproportionate. How do you answer that? And Regev went on to answer that. And then after that, when Raed Malki came into the program, Siegel didn't even mention Ban Ki-moon's condemnation, even though Ban Ki-moon began with his condemnation of Palestinian rocket attacks and terrorism. So that's kind of one of those issues of an incomplete picture. Listeners who most likely didn't hear Ban Ki-moon's original statement now have no way of knowing that there has been condemnation on both sides, and they only see condemnation of Israel.
You flagged this as a persistent problem. So what's at the root of it?
Well, that's a complex question. First of all, I'll go on to cite one quick stat that shows how it is something that happens over time. We took a look at coverage over the course of a month back in 2000 during the beginning of the fighting, and we noticed about a consistent 35% to 65% ratio of Israeli speakers and words to word count and time to Palestinian word count and time. So this is something that you know, we looked at over a longer period of time. At the root of the problem, it's a tough one. It's a conflict that you know, many people feel strongly about, and the question of why the media gets it wrong, I think people on both sides, there's not one certain answer. I was looking at some comments by Jeffrey Goldberg, a writer for The Atlantic magazine, and what he wrote just a couple of days ago was, it's absolutely astonishing to me how interested the world is in Israel's failings. And then he went on to cite an anecdote of a Kurdish friend of his who was wishing that the Kurds were fighting the Jews, and when Mr. Goldberg asked why, the Kurdish man responded, because the world only pays attention when you have Jewish enemies.
Well, does this translate, Gilad, into an inordinate emphasis on the plight of the Palestinians? Because that certainly is colorful, is interesting to hear about for listeners.
It is. It's not to say it's not interesting, and it's not to say that it's not something worth covering. But it does certainly mean that this is a conflict that's focused in on much more closely than other conflicts, and begins to kind of lose it. People begin to lose a sense of proportion when they kind of hear about this conflict all the time, which I think is a somewhat separate issue. Back to as to why the media get it wrong, there's a lot of theories that different people have. I mean, sometimes every once in a while you'll hear someone citing anti-Semitism. For example, I think a British writer named Martin Amis once said that it's a great tradition of the British left to support Palestine, but when you come up to this question, he said, you can feel the intelligence and balance leaving the hall with a shriek. And his view was, he said, I don't see any other explanation. It's secularized anti-Semitism. I think anti-Semitism does certainly exist, and sometimes it's an issue, but I think most people who comment on it don't believe that's really a driving force. And certainly with NPR, I don't think that there's any anti-Semitism that's causing the discrepancy in the way things are covered. If not, then what is it? It's possible, maybe it's an overly simplistic conception of the underdog and the belief that because the Palestinians are perceived as an underdog and have less sophisticated weapons, then, you know, people feel less comfortable perhaps scrutinizing this perceived underdog as if, you know, and mm-hmm. it may be human nature to kind of back, as if you're watching a Rocky movie, to back who on the surface seems to be the underdog, even though the complex.
It certainly is journalistic nature. I think you could find that in all kinds of different areas of coverage. Ali, let's go to you, and I'll put the same question to you, basically. What do you think is at the root of the problems that you hear when you listen to NPR cover this conflict?
Well, I think, I'd agree with Gilad Ini that there are indeed examples of good reporting on NPR. We might disagree on which particular reports we consider to be good. But I think the bigger problem is a lack of context and also an attempt to create balance where there really isn't any. And these problems, I think, are endemic to the media as a whole, but I'll just give you some specific examples. On NPR, over the past couple of weeks, we've heard repeatedly the Israeli claims about thousands of Palestinian rockets that have been fired at Israel. Now, if you do the math, these rockets, according to various media reports, carry about a charge, an explosive charge of about 2 pounds, usually made of TNT or fertilizer, homemade explosive with fertilizer. So if you take the maximum estimate of Israeli rockets that have ever been fired from the Gaza Strip, you come to about that the Palestinians have fired about 12 to 15 tons of explosives into Israel over a period of 8 years. Okay. That sounds like a lot. But here's a statistic that it's never contrasted with, that on the very first day, December 27th, of Israel's attack on Gaza, Israel dropped 100 tons of bombs. And we're not talking about fertilizer bombs. We're talking about military-grade high explosives. And here's another fact that comes from a Human Rights Watch report called Indiscriminate Fire, published in July 2007 and available on their website. And I quote from it. It says, from September 2005 through May 2007, the Israeli army fired 14,617 artillery shells into Gaza compared to 2,700 fired into Israel by Palestinian groups. Now, what that indicates to me is the fact that you don't hear that on NPR or in the New York Times or other places is that many journalists are afraid to state as facts anything that disturbs the notion that there is a balance and that equal sides are fighting. And I think because many of the journalists, particularly at NPR, are so terrified of being criticized and having letter campaigns and write-in campaigns, usually by people who haven't actually heard the coverage they're complaining about, they take this ultra cautious position where they say, you know, the Israelis said this and the Palestinians said that, you decide. Mm-hmm. And they abdicate the responsibility to actually investigate the facts and context and get sources and information from outside the claim and counterclaim.
Do you think the impulse for balance has any place in the coverage of this conflict?
Well, I think the impulse for balance is correct in the sense that we should certainly hear what Israelis think, and we should certainly hear what Palestinians think. I think we should hear about the experiences of Israelis and Palestinians, but that points to another problem. NPR, like every other American network and newspaper, does not base its news bureaus in the occupied Gaza Strip or in the occupied West Bank. They place their bureaus in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, where the journalists will live a middle-class Israeli-style life. So they will identify through their circumstances with the life of a typical middle-class Israeli.
Now, NPR, I should just point out, NPR, for their part, has said just this week, I think, that they want to get reporters into Gaza, but they can't. And
well,
that may, be because of the Israeli government's preventing them from,
from
doing that.
Well, exactly, because of the military censorship in Israel now and the fact that Israel blocked journalists from going into Gaza. I think because it doesn't want journalists to see what's going on there. But that points out the problem. Had the Bureau already been there, they would not have had that problem. And the fact is, no American news organization I can think of has ever considered Palestinian lives and experiences important enough to place their main or even an equally sized news bureau in a Palestinian city. So it's very easy then for Israel to control the narrative by slamming shut the border, and the journalists then cannot go and report where the story is happening.
Right.
The story is happening in Gaza. It's not happening in Israel.
Well, NPR does use freelance reporters and stringers from Gaza. Admittedly, it's a difficult situation. Don't you agree with what Gilad was saying, though, that there's an awful lot of airtime devoted to the stories of the plight of the Palestinian people?
No, I wouldn't agree with that. I would agree that there's an awful lot of airtime given to this story, but much of it is to the plight of Israelis disproportionately so. I mean, just look at the scale of this. Can you imagine if 250 Israeli children had been killed in the space of 10 days? I mean, the New York Times, I know we're focusing on NPR, but that is sort of, I think of NPR as the New York Times of the air. The images that you see on the front page, it's like almost one-to-one or even more images of mourning Israelis. The number of Palestinian children killed in the past 10 days exceeds by far the entire number of Israeli children killed since the year 2000 in this conflict. That is disproportionate. That is not balanced, and the coverage should reflect that.
I just want to be clear, and then I'll go back to you, Gilad, in just a moment. Ali, you think this is mostly due to sort of circumstantial, logistical factors that are shaping the coverage in large part? There's nothing more sort of more sinister going on in terms of their intentions or underlying bias as regards the story?
I think that some of the biases that are inbuilt are ones that are more endemic and not necessarily conscious, in the sense that Israelis present themselves and look like, quote-unquote, us, middle-class Western people who we can identify with. Palestinians, from our perspective, look strange and foreign. They're easily demonized. They don't speak a language we understand. We can't possibly, as you know, middle-class Americans, as most NPR listeners are, identify with the experience of Palestinians who have been refugees in Gaza for 80 years, having been forced to leave homes in what is now Israel, southern Israel, the very areas that Palestinians are firing missiles at. It's very hard for us to identify that as middle-class Americans. So I think journalists have a responsibility to do extra work to humanize and relate the experience of those who appear to be very foreign or other to us.
Thank you. Gilad, what do you make of some of these arguments, in particular the informational and kind of cultural advantages that Israel would seem to have when it comes to this story and how it plays in the U.S.?
I can't help but wonder if Mr. Abunima is looking at a different media as a whole than I'm seeing, because I'd actually argue the flip side of much of what he has said. For example, he spoke about the size of the warheads in the Qassam rockets. Not mentioned is the Grad rockets that have gotten into the mix, which are sophisticated and imported from China and Russia with much larger warheads. But I think readers will have to kind of check this against their own experience, of course, listeners and readers. But when I'm reading and listening to coverage of the conflict, I almost ad nauseum hear references to the Qassam rockets as crude or homemade rockets. Homemade almost evokes an apple pie.
These rockets coming out of Gaza.
Out of Gaza towards Israel. And I think this repeated reference of these rockets as crude and simple has the overall effect of minimizing the kind of extreme stress that this puts on residents of southern Israel,
who are
generally overlooked.
But you can't really compare the impact of those rockets, no matter what you call them, to the impact of 10 days, let alone 3 years of Israeli bombardment of the Gaza Strip. I mean, in 2008, the number of Palestinians killed in the Gaza Strip
Ali,
is 1,000.
Ali, let's let Gilad answer your point there.
So again, I think that there are repeated references to the nature of the Qassam rockets and putting aside the issue of more sophisticated Grad rockets that Palestinians are firing, which minimizes the impact that it has on residents in southern Israel, even if it's a different type of impact.
Right.
Residents in southern Israel do have bomb shelters, but the idea of having to run within 30 seconds or so to a bomb shelter repeatedly, as is the case when barrages of rockets fly in, is an issue that causes about one third of Israeli children to have post-traumatic stress disorder, and certainly civilians on both sides are suffering.
But
I think another important issue here is you
also
don't hear about when one references the type of rocket being fired one way and the type of rocket being fired the other way, what gets lost in much of the media coverage is the essential difference between the targets of this rocket fire. Hamas and Islamic Jihad are very open in who they're targeting. They're launching their missiles, which don't have much of a navigation system, in fact, don't have a navigation system at all, into the heart of Israeli towns like Sderot or cities like Ashkelon, and they're basically firing their rockets at civilians.
Sure, and the Israelis on the other hand.
Israel's powerful weapons are targeting Hamas fighters and Hamas infrastructure, and it's clear, of course, that there are some very tragic civilian casualties that result from there, but the issue of the difference in target and the difference of the aims of the two sides also tends to get lost.
Ali, let me let you briefly answer that before we move on.
Well, I mean, that's a totally spurious point, because Israel has been bombing mosques. It bombed the Palestinian Legislative Council. The International Committee for the Red Cross has said that they've seen entire civilian neighborhoods bombed and targeted, and people in Gaza have nowhere to flee. I mean, after initially claiming that there were Palestinians firing mortars from the UNRWA school that was bombed, Israel was forced to retract that claim, just as it did in similar instances in Lebanon. So when you know that you know dropping hundreds of tons of high explosives on one of the most densely packed places on Earth, when you can reasonably predict, in fact, certainly predict, that is going to cause massive civilian deaths and injuries, as indeed it has, under international law, you're not absolved just because you say, I didn't mean to. It's what you can foresee will be the result of your actions that counts. And so simply saying, well, Israel didn't mean it, doesn't mean anything in international law.
So you both
It does mean something in terms of media coverage, and media isn't only meant to kind of pontificate on what international law is, but they do need to kind of give a full rounded picture of the conflict.
I'm going to stop this particular strain of discussion and go in a different direction if I could. So you both find on each side, you know, facts that are missing, things that are out of proportion. If I'm in NPR's shoes, or any journalism entity for that matter, it's almost comforting to know that you're getting flack from both sides. There's a saying in journalism that if both sides are mad at you, you must be doing something right. Agree? Either of you can take that.
I absolutely disagree. It's a clever saying, but I don't think it's true. And I can only guess that Mr. Abu Nima might agree with me on this point. It's very easy to get both sides to speak, and we probably have different views on what causes each respective side to speak up, but it eventually becomes meaningless what both sides are saying, and what becomes essential is the actual reporting and the amount of time given to speakers from each side and the amount of time devoted to the concerns of each side and what's being said and what's not being said. So unfortunately, that formula doesn't exactly work, I think.
Ali, is it possible to have both sides in this conflict be happy with us as journalists?
I don't know, but I don't think that the role of journalists is to make both sides happy, and I think that that's often the mistake NPR makes, is they think that that both sides have to be happy. I think the role of journalists is to listen to the facts, to investigate, and to help guide listeners to say, well, this person's claims are more credible than that person's claims, and here are the reasons why. I think that if journalists don't do that, then they don't really provide much value. But I think we live in a political climate where to criticize Israel is to bring on your head very vigorous campaigns from pro-Israel groups. We've seen attempts by pro-Israel groups to boycott newspapers, major newspapers in this country. We've seen calls for people not to donate money to various public radio stations. And that creates an atmosphere of intimidation for journalists who want to be a little bit less cautious and more investigative when it comes to Israel. And you only have to look at international media to see how out of whack and cautious our discussion is. I mean, you can
aren't you
in the Israeli media.
Aren't you both and your groups just sort of creating that kind of spiral of kind of intimidation that the media fears about misstepping and generating complaints?
Well, we've never called for a boycott or intimidated people or done any of that kind of activity. And what we try to do, and in fact, what I always tell people who say, well, you know, what can we do about the coverage we don't like? A point I always make is, you know, also communicate with journalists about things you do like. Let them know the things that you think are informative and educational. Because one thing journalists and editors always tell me, particularly on this story, is we never get any positive feedback. So positive feedback is just as important as complaining, and I always encourage that.
Well, I'm going to pin you down on that. Do you have any positive feedback for NPR at this point on their coverage of the crisis?
Well, I've been not very pleased with the current coverage, and I've been watching Al Jazeera a lot, which is available in English on the Internet, because they have reporters in Gaza, and I can see for myself what is happening. But I have over the years had positive feedback for NPR, and I have been careful to communicate it just as vigorously as my many, many complaints.
Galad, let me ask you about that same question, the dynamics here when you have groups like yours that are so closely monitoring things. Do you think you maybe sort of set the media on edge so they feel like they have to be so balanced that perhaps it doesn't make sense sometimes?
Not so much, and certainly not any more than the media in its role as a fourth estate needs to, you know, to use your words, set on edge. The media is there to set on edge the powers that be in the government, and I definitely believe that there needs to be that same kind of force that looks at the media and the way they're handling things. It's not an issue of the media only gets to judge and is immune from the criticism of the public, and the public certainly does have a lot of criticisms, and I think that it's important that criticism be relayed to the editors and others who are responsible for the media coverage.
I want to ask you both, before we go, Galad first, and then Ali, I'll give you the last word. If you could, in, say, a minute or less, a few concrete steps that you would recommend for National Public Radio to improve their reporting from the conflict in your eyes.
I think they need to go in more depth about the conflict in the whole. I think they need to devote features and significant time to the issue of human shields used by Hamas. For example, there were several eyewitnesses, Gazans, who did see known mortarmen around the school that was hit. And I think that's an issue worth more than just a brief passing mention as if it's an afterthought. I think that's something that should be discussed for, you know, in depth with a long segment, just like they do other issues. I think NPR needs to focus on Hamas and its anti-Semitic charter and its goals of eliminating Israel off the map completely, and the especially maybe the indoctrination by the Palestinian, by many in the Palestinian side, especially Hamas, of you know, kind of educating children towards a hateful view of the other side. These are all issues that are part and parcel of the conflict that need to be looked at very closely.
But there's nothing structural that you would change about the way their operation works.
I think they need to try harder at following media ethics. I think they need a truly independent ombudsman and truly independent outside eyes to kind of help shuttle them to the kind of objective and fair journalism. And they themselves have to kind of remind themselves of the canons of journalism and journalistic ethics every so often, because that's a key.
All right. And Ali, to you, what are a few concrete changes that you'd like to see made that might make things better as far as you're concerned?
Yeah, I think some people would advise that, you know, for the coverage to be better, NPR should put forward the issues and talking points that they think are important or that they think will sway public opinion in their direction. And that's a little bit what I hear Gilad saying. But what I would suggest more is that NPR should put a bureau or more than one bureau inside a Palestinian community in the Gaza Strip, in the West Bank. I mean, I've heard the excuse before that it's too dangerous, but they've had bureaus in Iraq when it's been much, much, much more dangerous, in Afghanistan, and I think there's no excuse on this issue that concerns so many people not to have bureaus in Palestinian communities. The second thing I would recommend is that NPR should seek analysis from a far wider range of viewpoints. I find that the people they call on to interpret events come from a very narrow, inside the Beltway perspective, a lot from think tanks who have been consistently wrong on this issue or who have interests in the issue that are not properly disclosed to listeners. So I think seeking opinion from a wider range of viewpoints would also enhance listeners' understanding of the issues.
Interestingly, I actually agree with the suggestion that the NPR and other media outlets have a bureau in Gaza. It's probably for a different reason, is because I think if there are bureaus in Gaza, then it makes it more likely that journalists will be less reliant on Palestinian stringers who live in Gaza and might be more susceptible to intimidation.
Wait a minute, Gilad, because what you seem to be saying to people is that Palestinians are inherently untrustworthy.
Well, I don't want to go there.
No.
I think what I said was that Palestinians who live in the community are more susceptible to intimidation by Hamas.
Well, this is sort of a propagandistic point that you're just conjecturing about. There's no basis that reporters have been intimidated by Hamas any more than they're intimidated by Fatah or indeed by
this
Israel.
Is beyond the scope of our interview, and I should say that. Inasmuch as we have at least a tentative agreement on one particular point, put a bureau in Gaza, I think it's nice to end there. I want to thank you both for joining us for this somewhat challenging conversation.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Ali Abunima publishes the Electronic Intifada online journal at electronicintifada.net. Gilad Aini is a senior research analyst with the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America. That's CAMERA. .org. All right. Well, you guys will have to call each other on the phone independently if you want to continue the conversation. But I do think this, it's difficult, of course, not to stray into the specifics and details that you both disagree so passionately on. But I think in terms of a conversation about the media and about the coverage here, NPR listeners and NPR, if they're listening, can certainly learn something from it. So thank you both.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay, and I'll check with Santa, make sure there's nothing he thinks we need to retake. No, we're in good shape. We're in about a half hour, which is sort of what we'd planned. And Santa will be in touch with both of you, letting you know where you can listen to the final product.
Great. Okay. Thanks very much.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.